This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Ticks are here. That is well established. And so is Lyme disease. The Vermont Department of Health has recorded steadily increasing numbers of reported cases over the last several years. For patients, a diagnosis of Lyme could mean a quick course of antibiotics. But 10 to 20% of people diagnosed with Lyme continue to suffer symptoms after treatment. Most doctors believe this is called post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome, a case of long-term effects that were caused by the disease, but that the disease itself is no longer active. But some patients and some doctors believe the disease is still active, and they say a long-term course of antibiotics is the most effective cure. By long-term, I mean maybe even a couple of years of antibiotics. Patients who go this course say they have felt marginalized by mainstream clinicians, told they're imagining their symptoms, and told there's nothing that can be done. But doctors who disagree with the chronic Lyme diagnosis say patients are being misled by well-meaning physicians and that whatever it is they do have is not being treated properly. Today, we're going to try to get a better understanding of why there's so much debate. Why isn't there better testing? Why isn't there more consensus on what these long-term symptoms actually are? But first, we're going to find out a little bit more about the spread of ticks and Lyme in Vermont with Alan Giese, a professor of natural sciences at Linden State College and an expert on disease-carrying ticks. Alan Giese, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So where in Vermont are the ticks?
It's probably reasonable to assume that they are just about everywhere in Vermont. I think it's what I've learned over the last few years is it's maybe too simplistic to think that they're in certain places and not in other places. I suspect that where we currently don't find them, which is really the Northeast Kingdom, they're there. They're just there at very low levels, so they're sort of undetectable. We don't find them very often.
And so does that mean that they are also probably spreading Lyme at a lower rate or a slower rate than in places where there are higher concentrations?
Well, that's been a big surprise of the data that we've collected over the last few years. We really expected to see the prevalence of Lyme be lowest where the tick densities are lowest, because the transmission dynamics would suggest that the more ticks you have feeding on hosts, the more efficient the transmission of the pathogen will be from one generation of ticks to the next. What we've actually found is that there's a very weak relationship. So even in areas where we have really low densities of ticks based on our collections, the prevalence of Lyme is still hovering right around 50%. So even if you're in an area that where ticks aren't very common, if you do end up with one, our data suggests that you should still be very concerned about Lyme disease.
And when you say 50%, you mean half the ticks out there are carrying Lyme?
Yeah, statewide, it's at 51% right now based on about 800 ticks that we've had tested over the last few years. It ranges from one site to the next. The lowest site is about 25%, and the highest is almost 70%. But again, there's no relationship between tick density and that prevalence. Or there is, but it's a very, very weak relationship.
Do you understand why in some places the prevalence of Lyme in the ticks is at 25%, whereas it's 70% in other places?
No. Really, what we thought we would probably see was that it would be caused by density based on those transmission dynamics. But that didn't turn out to be true, so now we have to scratch our heads and go back and think what might be going on and come up with some ways to collect data to look at other possible drivers of that relationship.
And you have no working theory even at this point?
I don't.
Huh.
I think it may be random.
Random as in you're just not collecting the right ticks, or random as in it just happens to be that way, that the prevalence of Lyme?
Right. So I think we can rule out random as we're not collecting the right ticks, because our sample sizes are high enough that we should be getting fairly accurate estimates. If we only had two or three or four ticks at a site, that you would expect that number to bump around a lot. But we're up to over 50 ticks at each of the sites. We have 12 sites in Vermont where we collect ticks every year. Our sample sizes are sufficient that those numbers shouldn't be influenced by random fluctuations in sampling. So I think it probably has more to do with how that population of ticks became established and whether the early ticks that arrived there were carriers of Lyme disease, in which case the pathogen would get an early jump and you would see high prevalence, as opposed to a situation where the early ticks to arrive at a particular location were mostly Borrelia negative, and then that would set off a course for that population to have a low prevalence for a while. So I think the randomness may have to do with what happens early on when the first ticks reach an area.
Hmm.
But it would be a stretch to call that much more of conjecture, much more than conjecture at this point. I'm sort of grasping at straws, I'll admit.
Alan Giese, do you have a sense of whether or not it's going to be possible for humans to control the tick population in any given area?
I think that it's probably possible on a very small scale, say around an individual residence. I think that it will be expensive and labor-intensive. I don't pretend it will be easy, but I think it's possible on a very small scale around a residence. I don't think it will be possible regionally, county-wide or region-wide within the state. I think that would be it would be cost prohibitive in terms of the financial cost, but also in terms of the cost of damage we might cause to the environment by what it might take to go out there and try to control ticks.
And do you see the tick populations continuing to spread north?
I do. And then I base that on research that people have done, some modeling research that some people have done out of Montreal that suggests that the conditions are currently appropriate for ticks well north of us, and that climate models suggest that they are going to improve their quality for ticks as the decades go on here. So we would expect them to keep moving northward, yes, unfortunately. Hate to be the bearer of bad news.
Yeah, it sounds... Every question we're asking you is sort of bad news at this point. Alan, we're going to have some medical professionals on in a little while, and we're going to talk about Lyme disease and treatment. But just from the perspective of somebody who's an expert on ticks and disease-carrying ticks, do you have a sense of why it's so difficult to vaccinate humans against Lyme disease?
I don't. It's extremely difficult to come up with vaccines in general that don't also have negative side effects on the host. That's the big challenge. The combination of having a negative effect on the pathogen without a negative effect on the person who's getting the vaccine is sort of the trick. I think with Borrelia in particular, which is the pathogen that causes Lyme disease, if you can imagine the life of a Borrelia bacterium, it has to exist in potentially a mouse, it has to exist in a tick, then it moves potentially to a chipmunk or a squirrel or a robin, then back to a tick, and then ultimately maybe to a deer or a human. That individual bacterium has to have evolved the molecular machinery to evade many, many different immune systems, because each of those host organisms that I named has its own immune system. So I think there's a possible strand of reasoning where you might start to understand why it's so difficult to vaccinate it against these guys, because they're quite good at evading immune systems. If they weren't, they wouldn't survive all these different hosts they have to go through.
That's Alan Giese. He's an expert in disease-carrying ticks, and he's a professor of natural sciences at Linden State College. Thanks again for talking with us, Alan. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you.
We are talking about Lyme disease today, and we've been learning a little bit about the ticks that spread Lyme disease to humans. Meanwhile, the treatment of the disease continues to be a matter of controversy. Doctors disagree over the existence of what's often called chronic Lyme disease. Most agree that some patients suffer long-term effects, but what is causing the symptoms is still up in the air, and how to treat those symptoms is a source of much debate. Some doctors treat patients who have persistent symptoms with long-term courses of antibiotics. Last year, Vermont passed a bill with the intent to ensure that doctors who use this type of long-term treatment won't face punishment. But the law certainly hasn't ended the debate. We're going to spend some time now talking about why there is dispute in the medical community and what's known and what's still not fully understood about Lyme disease. And listeners, I know many of you have questions you've been posting on our Facebook page in advance of the program. You can continue to post your thoughts there. Go to Vermont Edition's Facebook page. Or if you have a question, Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We're joined now by Dr. Tom Moorcroft, who's an osteopathic physician based in Berlin, Connecticut, and who treats many patients with chronic Lyme disease. He's on the board of directors at ILADS, that's the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, and he's what is often known in the Lyme community as a Lyme-literate doctor. Dr. Moorcroft, thanks for being on the program.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
We're also joined today by Dr. Jeffrey Parsonet. He's a professor of medicine at Dartmouth College, and he's a specialist in infectious diseases. He doesn't believe in this diagnosis of chronic Lyme disease. We're going to get into that a little bit more. Dr. Parsonet, thank you for being with us today as well.
Just to clarify, I believe that people suffer long-term. It just means that I don't believe that long-term antibiotics are the approach to this problem.
Absolutely. And that is exactly what we're going to get into. Let me just ask you first, Dr. Parsonet, to begin with, do you have a sense of why Vermont might have such a high rate of Lyme disease? We actually have one of the highest rates of Lyme disease in the country, according to the Centers for Disease Control. In 2013, it was reported that we had nearly 10 times the national average. Do you have a sense of why that might be?
Well, actually, I was just looking at the CDC statistics, and in fact, we have the highest per capita incidence of Lyme disease now in the country per capita. It has to do with environment and exposure to ticks, and as your first guest was talking about, the very, very high percentage of ticks that are now infected with this organism. And we are a rural state, so, you know, there's not a lot of Lyme disease in Manhattan, but when people are living in rural areas like we are, and as the tick and the infected ticks become more prevalent, it's set up for a high incidence of Lyme.
All right. So Dr. Parsonet, you wanted to clarify there when I said that, you know, you don't believe in this diagnosis of chronic Lyme disease. And let's get into that. And Dr. Moorcroft will bring you in here, too, because first of all, let me just get on the table. Is there consensus that some people who are diagnosed with and treated for Lyme disease will suffer from persistent symptoms?
Yes, I would say that's true, yes.
So absolutely. The disagreement is over whether or not this is an active case of the disease and then how to treat.
That's right. It has to do with whether or not there are still viable, that is, living bacteria of this organism that are still causing actual infection, or whether we're dealing with long-term non-infectious complications. And if there are many, many infectious diseases where similar things like that occur.
Diseases like strep throat.
Sure, like rheumatic fever. Rheumatic fever is a strep infection, and then decades later people get valve damage even though they don't have strep anymore. And the treatment for that would not be more antibiotics. The treatment is quite different. So, you know, when you have immunologic things happen to you, when your body is fighting infections, various things happen that can set up for long-term consequences that don't reflect persistence of the organism itself.
Okay. So, Dr. Moorcroft, I want to turn to you and get your perspective on this, and we'll talk a little bit more about what the right course of treatment might be and why there are differences of opinion in that. Why do you believe in this diagnosis of chronic Lyme disease and an active, ongoing case of the disease?
Well, I mean, I think I would agree with what Dr. Parsonet said in part, is that there is the possibility of sort of a chronic symptoms that are non-infectious in nature. And I think that a lot of my patients find that surprising because they think, you know, we're just going to say you have chronic Lyme disease and everything that you have revolves around that. And I don't agree with that, because there are certainly studies that support, having non-viable spirochetes, you know, trapped in something like the membranes within the knee joint, the synovial membrane, causing symptoms in the absence of a persistent, actual, growable infection. However, there are also a lot of studies that do suggest persistence of Lyme spirochetes, both in humans and in animal models. And there are people who, when we treat them with a retreatment course of antibiotics, be that somewhat short or even somewhat longer, have pretty significant improvements. So I think when I look at people, a lot of people say, hey, you're a Lyme specialist. I said, no, I'm a doctor, and I happen to treat people with Lyme disease. I want to get to the cause of your symptoms. And if it's an autoimmune situation, I want to know about that. And if it's just if it's permanent damage, I'd like to know about that. But I also think that the science certainly points in the direction of the possibility of persistence in some of our patients. And when we clinically look at them and we take, you know, their course and their history and all the symptoms that they have, and then we look at a laboratory workup and we come to the conclusion that there's a possibility of a chronic infection, and then we create a treatment plan, and when that treatment plan leads them to have an improvement in their quality of life and a decrease in their suffering, you know, I tend to believe that, you know, those the antibiotics that we prescribed, or even an herbal treatment for that matter, those things are, you know, pointing in the direction of what the emerging evidence is showing us, which is that persistence of infection is possible.
So, Dr. Moorcroft, given that, why aren't places like the CDC and the Vermont Department of Health calling chronic Lyme disease an active case of the disease a reality?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the reason we have a huge debate in situations like this is that the evidence is not clear. I mean, some evidence points to persistence maybe being less likely, and other evidence points to it being very likely. If there was very clear evidence in this particular infectious disease, we would probably all do the same thing. I think that all the parties involved, for the most part, are doing the very best they can for the patients, and I think that a lot of times we can confuse good scientific debate with a patient-centered medical model for, you know, some sort of big argument in war. I mean, there's certainly political aspects to this, but for the most part, most of the infectious disease specialists and the epidemiologists at the state and national departments of, you know, health or the CDC that I've talked to are really just trying to do the best they can. And the problem is there's not a lot of money in research for infectious diseases. So our evidence is maybe not as good as it would be, say, in high levels of cholesterol, where you get a huge amount of funding from a pharmaceutical company. So we're dealing with less research dollars, and the research is not always crystal clear. So that's where clinicians have to treat the patient, you know, in a shared medical decision-making model where we tell the patients, this is the evidence that's out there, this is the evidence I agree with, this is the evidence I don't agree with, these are the reasons why, and this is what I think is going on with you. What do you think? And let's make a team decision.
Dr. Parsonet, do you agree that there isn't enough research and that not everything is known about this?
I would say so. I think that Dr. Moorcroft has brought up some interesting questions about treating people, and when they benefit, then going with that treatment. But in terms of your question, yes, there were some big studies done where looking at the effect of long-term antibiotics. And the only really good way to do a research study on treatment is to do what's called a double-blind randomized study, where neither the doctor nor the patient knows which form of therapy they're getting. Because when you treat someone who thinks they're going to benefit from a certain treatment, they often do, the well-known placebo effect. And also, many of the manifestations of Lyme disease are symptoms that we all experience fairly often, fatigue, joint aches, muscle aches, etc. So when the big studies that were done now about 10 years ago looking at treatment of Lyme did not show a benefit in a double-blind randomized study to long-term therapy. Okay, so the infectious disease people really hang their hat on that study. It wasn't a huge study. There were technical issues with the study that some people rightfully criticized. And it would be wonderful to do a very large double-blind randomized study of various kinds of treatments. And it could be extended beyond just antibiotics. And that is a very costly thing to do and has to be funded by somebody. So in that sense, I do think that additional funding would be a benefit.
But right now, what the trials that have been done have shown is that in those randomized double-blind trials, the long-term course of antibiotics was not a more effective treatment than the placebo.
That's correct.
So, Dr. Moorcroft, I can hear you wanting to weigh in there.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think there's, you know, everybody who reads a study, actually everybody who writes a study is going to come up with a different, you know, conclusion based on their results. And that's the beauty of the peer-reviewed process, is we do these double-blind placebo-controlled studies as our gold standard in research. But there are other types of studies that help guide what we do. And then, you know...
Wait, are you discounting the double-blind placebo?
No. What I'm saying is that we hold that as the highest, you know, generally as the highest level of scientific research in terms of the result, you know, checking whether, say, an antibiotic retreatment trial in Lyme disease was effective. But there are other types of research that are of lesser control that may also help us. But no, I would agree with what Dr. Parsonet said in terms of the medical research. But there are people who do those studies, and there are people who review those results. And once we publish them, then we have a discussion. And there have been published reviews of those articles or those studies that showed no benefit, where when the authors teased apart things in a different way than the original authors did, they saw that there were some benefits. And this is sort of where the controversy is, because the large studies in Lyme disease are, you know, 50, 100, 150 people. They're not, you know, some of these cardiovascular studies we're looking at are thousands, if not tens of thousands of people. So, you know, we don't have as much information. And, you know, the ILADS, the International Lyme-Associated Diseases Society, has published recently a set of guidelines, you know, that they focus on just three basic questions. But within that document, they went through and really broke apart these studies and what and told us, it was very transparent, why did the three people who wrote the guidelines feel a certain way, and why did they make a certain judgment? If we said it was a low level of evidence in the paper, they would tell you why that was the case. And then they would also suggest how they evaluated the study to find actually maybe there is some benefit. But the point, I think the most important point is, we're in a situation where the studies are not clear, and these guidelines even state that the quality of evidence is low based on a standard grading evaluation system. So we need more studies. But I would disagree that those studies that are currently out there are crystal clear that retreatment of Lyme disease does not help.
We're going to get a little bit more into that in just a moment. I have to take a quick break. We're talking about Lyme disease today, and we're trying to understand why there is debate about the disease and about long-term symptoms, what's causing them, and how to treat them. Clearly, more study is needed to figure out what the heck is going on with Lyme disease, how it works, and why some patients continue to have these symptoms long after diagnosis and treatment. Listeners, if you want to share your story, you can post it on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net, or you can call with a question, 1-800-639-2211. Jeff says, look, there's no reason for the debate to continue. There's already an enormous amount of research that explains that chronic Lyme disease is very real and that there are treatments to help relieve suffering. Instead of arguing about it any longer, physicians and researchers should focus their energies on prevention, diagnosis, and cure. Cameron says, look, I personally don't believe that there is a chronic Lyme disease. Vague symptoms and broad diagnostic criteria have led to naming a chronic condition. And Michelle says, I met one lady a few years ago who'd gotten so bad she was in a wheelchair before they realized what it was. She was eventually able to get out of the chair once treated, but who knows what would have happened if she wasn't. Certainly a lot of fear out there as well about what Lyme disease could lead to. So we're trying to get a little bit more to the bottom of that today. Share your comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking about Lyme disease. We're learning more about why there is so much debate over treatment and even about the disease itself with Dr. Tom Moorcroft, who's an osteopathic physician based in Berlin, Connecticut, and who treats patients with chronic Lyme disease, sometimes using long-term courses of antibiotics. We're also talking with Dr. Jeffrey Parsonet. He's a professor of medicine at Dartmouth College and a specialist in infectious diseases. And I'd like to bring into the conversation now David Herlihy, who's executive director of the Vermont Board of Medical Practice. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thanks, Jay.
So let me ask you first, since we have you here now, your job with the Vermont Board of Medical Practice is basically, as I understand it, to listen to a large group of physicians and medical practitioners and then basically establish common practices of medicine. Is that pretty much right?
Well, not quite.
Okay.
The board's mission is to license and oversee the practice of medicine. And so on the licensing side, it's pretty obvious what we do. We review people's credentials, education, experience, and decide if they meet the criteria that are in the law. And then on the oversight side, most of our work is based upon complaints. And when the board receives a complaint, we investigate it, find out what happened in that case regarding the patient's care and make determinations based upon the standards that exist both in the statute and out there that's known as the standard of care.
And when the state was considering passing a new law relating to Lyme disease treatment, the Vermont Board of Medical Practice was on the record as being against that new law that did pass, that basically allows physicians to use recommended treatment protocols from a number of organizations, including the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, which does have as part of its protocol this long-term, long-course antibiotic treatment. Why did you oppose that, Bill?
Well, really, the overwhelming reason why the board was against that is because the standard of care is not set in law. The standard of care is something that exists out there in the medical community, and it's the board's job when presented with a case that involves a question of the standard of care to determine what that is. The standard of care is a live thing. It evolves sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And in any given case, it's very involved in trying to decide just what are the factors that apply and what is the appropriate standard of care in that case. Now, the board is made up. We have a majority of our board members are physicians, and we rely on their professional expertise. But when we have a case that's identified by them is potentially presenting of a failure to meet that standard of care, at that point, we bring in experts, and we contract with experts, and they guide the board as to whether or not there was a breach of the standard of care in that case. So the board is against generally the idea of saying we're going to set in stone in law and decided by the legislature and based upon input from all sorts of sources what the standard of care is, rather than relying on that professional science-based medical perspective.
Dr. Moorcroft, I know you don't practice medicine in Vermont, but my understanding of one of the reasons why this was actually brought to the legislature was that some doctors in Vermont who believe what you believe and do sometimes prescribe a long-term course of antibiotics were worried that they might face medical malpractice suits or might get in trouble in one way or another. Is that something that you think is a legitimate concern?
No, I think it is. I mean, David just pointed out that the standard of care is based upon what the physicians do on the front lines. And, you know, there have been cases in many states, including the state in which I practice, where people have been, you know, brought under scrutiny just for the fact that they treated Lyme disease more like it was tuberculosis and more like it actually has a slow reproductive cycle, which it does, you know. I mean, so I think the fear is real. And, you know, I think that at least in Connecticut, and it sounds like the Vermont law is not saying you should treat all people with Lyme disease for a long period of time, irregardless of the science and irregardless of the patient's course. It's just saying that you as a physician have the option to, and that people who are, you know, physicians disagree with each other very professionally all the time. And sometimes one of the physicians is more correct than the other one, and that happens. It's a give and take throughout your career with all your other colleagues with the goal of taking the best care of the patient. And so I think that some of the laws are just trying to protect physician autonomy as well as the patient's autonomy to make a decision on their own about their care as long as they're being informed properly. In Connecticut, our law supposedly protects me for making a professional medical decision as long as I follow all the other good standards of practice and document things properly. But it doesn't say I can just willy-nilly go and throw out antibiotics for no reason. And I think the other clarification is, I think in the past, ILADS has been looked at as a lot of saying long-term courses of antibiotics are for everybody. And in the new guidelines, it's very clear most of the time what they're saying is a 4 to 6 week course of treatment, if it's used as a retreatment, is then followed by reassessment. So we're not doing, none of us are recommending long courses of antibiotics unless those are being helpful. So
I want want to point out here that one of the reasons we have Dr. Moorcroft on the program, who practices in Connecticut, is because we had a lot of trouble getting a Vermont doctor who practices this kind of treatment protocol to come on the show. In fact, one guest we had lined up canceled at the very last minute because she said her patients called her and said, please don't do this. We're afraid that you are going to lose your license, and then who will treat us? David Herlihy, have you seen anything like that, any complaints coming in about doctors who treat with alternative courses of treatment for Lyme disease?
Well, I can only comment about cases that have become public. And under Vermont law, our cases are confidential unless and until they become public. And the way they become public is by the board filing public charges against a physician or entering into an agreement with a physician where they acknowledge a unprofessional conduct and agree to sanctions. So I can't even say if we've had complaints like that. I can say that I find no evidence the board has ever had any kind of a public case involving that kind of treatment.
Dr. Parsonet, weigh in here. What are you thinking as you listen to this conversation?
Well, I want to make a comment about first about one of the letters that were sent in to you about the patient who was in a wheelchair before the diagnosis was made. And I wanted to clarify just one or two medical issues.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, if you're not treated properly, you can have chronic Lyme. And if Lyme disease is a bacterial infection, and if not treated, it can progress and cause serious neurologic and musculoskeletal and cardiac damage. So the example that your writer gave was a patient who was improperly treated by not having the disease recognized and being treated appropriately. So there is chronic Lyme if it's not treated properly. And there are cases where someone has Lyme and it isn't treated properly. For example, if someone already has involvement of the brain and they get treated with 2 weeks of an oral antibiotic, that's not proper treatment, and that can progress to cause chronic disease. There's another very important point to make about Lyme, and that is, unlike many other infectious diseases like chickenpox or mumps or things like that, where once you get it, then you're immune from getting it again, you can get Lyme disease over and over and over again. You're not protected from Lyme by having it once or twice, so that you can be treated and be better, and then even in the same season or in the following season, get it again. So that's sometimes confused with chronic Lyme. That's recurrent Lyme, and it's been proven that if you do careful DNA analysis of the bacteria, that it's a new infection, not an old one. So I think that is the basis for a lot of misunderstanding. And you asked earlier in the program about problems with testing. Testing is really not so bad if you understand certain things. One is that when you first get the rash of Lyme disease, the test is negative because it takes a while for antibodies to develop. And the other thing is that once you test positive for life, so that testing does become inadequate in looking at patients who might have either chronic infection or new infection. So there's some inherent difficulties in testing. It's not so much that the testing isn't accurate, it's that it's only helpful under certain circumstances.
Is anybody working on a better test, a more diagnostic test for people who have been infected and maybe being reinfected?
There are new kinds of tests coming along all the time and new improved tests, but I don't know that I've ever seen something that would help differentiate between old disease and new disease. It's a very good question, and I don't think so. So I'll just say from a personal experience, my sister-in-law lives on Block Island, which is a terrible, terrible place for Lyme disease, and I've treated her numerous times for Lyme disease because she keeps getting it, and there's no way I can tell. If she comes out with a fever in May, I can't tell whether she got Lyme disease or the flu. So it's a very difficult situation.
Dr. Moorcroft, what about a vaccine? You know, we've had several listeners who have called in or written in now saying, my dog can get a vaccine, why can't I?
Well, I think also my understanding of the testing, the laboratory testing for animals is that it's a little bit better than ours as well and can be more useful in different situations. My understanding is that the original vaccine had some efficacy, but it also had some difficulties and some side effects, and lack of consumer demand took it off of the market.
And it had to be given every year is the problem.
Yeah. So vaccines, are things that people are researching. I mean, I get an email about this every couple of days. And I'm not really, you know, being a frontline physician and not a researcher, I mean, I'm not up on the latest thing on the vaccine, but I know that people are working on it. And the same thing for testing. If I could make a quick comment, though, about what Dr. Parsonet said, and I think, at least when I interpret what I heard, was a lot of, and this is sort of my point, too, is that we need to educate people well. And you had brought up earlier the fear that comes up. Patients are really afraid, and patients come into my office, and so many of them tell me they have chronic Lyme disease. And the hardest appointment I have is telling people they don't have chronic Lyme disease because they think they found that thing which is going to really help them completely get better. And it's our responsibility as physicians to be educators. I mean, that's where the word physician comes from. The root comes from teacher. And my goal is to share all the evidence that I'm aware of from the right and the left, so to speak, and help people make decisions. And when Dr. Parsonet was educating us there, I feel like this is a really good conversation to have because we need to know the objective information and then know where there's disagreement. So education is key in this. And hopefully we'll have more to educate you on with vaccines in the near future.
Well, we'll look forward to that. And David Herlihy, before we let you go, you're not a physician, but you have to look at, as you said, all of this medical practice. Would you like to see more money spent on figuring out the really tricky specifics of this disease and how to treat it and how to prevent it?
Well, sure. As somebody who spends a lot of time in the outdoors, as does my family, I would love to see more effort and more money put into that.
That's David Herlihy. He's executive director of the Vermont Board of Medical Practice. We've also been talking with Dr. Jeffrey Parsonet, who's a professor of medicine at Dartmouth College and a specialist in infectious diseases, and Dr. Tom Moorcroft, who's an osteopathic physician based in Berlin, Connecticut. Thank you both very much. Thanks, all three of you, for being on the program today.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, why legislators in Vermont felt the need to make a law relating to green cemeteries. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. What do you want to happen to your body when you die? I know it's a morbid thought, but one many of us are concerned about. There are lots of considerations, financial, religious, cultural, familial. But one new trend in the funeral industry is a push for more eco-friendly burials. It feels a little bit strange to call it a new trend, given how humans were buried for thousands of years. But in fact, since the evolution of the steel-lined casket and the advancement in embalming methods, not to mention town cemetery ordinances, there are a lot of interventions for people who want their bodies buried in the ground. A new law goes into effect in Vermont on July 1st that codifies the state's approach to what are being called green burials. Here to walk us through the process is Josh Slocum, executive director of the Funeral Consumers Alliance, based in South Burlington. Josh, it's nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Jane. Hi.
So what exactly is the Vermont law intending to do here?
Simply make it easier for people who want to open a natural cemetery to do so without having to adhere to some of the regulations that are more appropriate to a conventional cemetery, such as fencing and the way graves are marked out and platted.
And in fact, in some cases, towns are required to like pull weeds and mow cemeteries. And this would say, yeah, that's not required by a town to do that kind of thing.
Right. And I think the first thing that people should understand is what we call green burial or natural burial is what our great-great-grandparents would have simply called burial, right? What it means is burial in the earth without embalming, without a metal casket, perhaps with a shroud or with a wood coffin, and without the concrete vault that is typically used in cemeteries to surround the casket and keep it level.
So isn't that already legal in Vermont? And if you wanted to be buried, for example, on private property?
Yes. A common misconception people have is that so-called green burial or burial without the interventions, as you described it, is somehow by default illegal. It's not. It's not illegal anywhere. One can always choose to have a simple, straightforward burial. But whether or not the cemetery that you use will accommodate that request is a different question.
In fact, in Vermont, my understanding is there is no set-aside cemetery that is known as a green cemetery where all of the people who are buried there are buried in this manner. Is that true? That's
correct. I think that there is some interest in seeing that happen. And obviously for Vermont, this is a natural, right?
Pun intended.
Yes. But really, I mean, in a state where we take such good care of the environment, where we understand that not only do we want that, but that it's important for our tourist industry, this just seems like something that could just sail through, and it did.
you're with the Funeral Consumers Alliance. Isn't this going to take money out of the pockets of people who specialize in selling people? And I don't mean this in any derogatory way, but who specialize in selling people fancy coffins and who are, you know, who do the embalming. Isn't this taking money out of your clients' pockets?
Well, now, and actually, Funeral Consumers Alliance, we're a consumer organization, so we are often seen, I think, incorrectly by funeral directors as an enemy. But what we're about is education and free options. And yes, it's certainly true that those who choose a green burial do not buy metal caskets. They don't buy vaults. But I think that any business has to adapt to changing consumer preferences. And smart, forward-thinking people in the funeral business will see that, I think.
So if there's no specific place set aside so far for Vermont to do this, you think there is interest, though. Is there more interest in other states? Are you seeing these green cemeteries cropping up?
Yes. When I first came to Vermont to take this job back in the early 2000s, I only knew of one green cemetery in South Carolina. At last count, there are at least 80 of them that are either dedicated natural cemeteries or they're portions of conventional or municipal cemeteries. And I want to point out that so-called green burial, right, has been going on all the time everywhere. Many traditional Jewish and Muslim communities practice that form of simple and direct burial. Many Amish families do. And people who have a private sort of family cemetery, maybe one grave on their rural land, of course, there's nothing that would require them to purchase the concrete vault or the casket.
Can you describe what these places look like? In a lot of cases, there's no traditional marker that would notate where a person has chosen to be buried.
Right. Well, it depends on the character of the land. These places look like what the land looks like. So I toured one in upstate New York a couple of years ago, and it's rolling hills on the side of it's pasture land and rock outcroppings and stands of trees. I mean, it's very familiar to what you'd see in Vermont. But the key to it is that the intervention into the land to manicure it the way that we are, the way we think of with conventional cemeteries is out. And a lot of times, if the graves are marked, it's an indigenous rock, a rock that you find there that's appropriate to the area, or you can find a grave by GPS coordinates, which is what a lot of green cemeteries do.
Is that required by towns to have those, at least a GPS coordinate, if you're going to have a cemetery in a town?
I don't know every specific town ordinance. And in a lot of cases, very small sort of pieces of law like that, very specific questions are not contemplated sort of explicitly in the regulations. But it's certainly true that you can have an accurate map of a cemetery if you take care to position it correctly and keep on top of where your GPS coordinates are. And people who are interested in natural burial are less interested in having a conventional marker there anyway. Part of the appeal is that that is absent.
What do you think people need to know about this, though, on the side of just thinking clearly about what you want and how to make sure that you get what you want? Obviously, by the time your loved ones are dealing with your death, it's out of your hands. So what should you be doing before you die to make sure that your wishes are both received and then followed through with?
Well, you can never guarantee that they're going to be followed through with, which is a sad reality I have to share with many people who call. But you can get a good start by having a frank family conversation. I mean, talk about your end-of-life funeral burial plans. Write them down and explore your options. A lot of what we think as Americans that we have to do or that we're not allowed to do when it comes to funerals is not true at all. So know what your options are, and then you can have a real conversation about what's going to make sense when a death comes to your family.
Have you had that conversation with your family?
Incessantly.
I suppose with
are
your
you
job.
Kidding? When I was 9 years old and I had to do a civics contribution for English class, everybody else went out to the newspaper publisher. Someone went to the bagel shop. Well, I went to the undertaker. So we've always had a very candid discussion about family life, and death is part of family life.
And is this something that appeals to you? Maybe I don't mean to get too personal into what you want to do, but in terms of this opening up of the ability for people who want to be buried in a way with less interventions and perhaps in some cases fewer dangerous chemicals that the undertaker might have to deal with?
Yes. When it comes to me personally, you know, I say to people, honestly, there are certain things I prefer and certain things that I don't. But what's most important to me is that my family and my survivors afterwards, that whatever they do for the funeral works for their budget and their philosophy and where they feel they need to be at the time.
That's Josh Slocum. He's executive director of the Funeral Consumers Alliance. Act 24, an act relating to natural burial grounds, goes into effect in Vermont on July 1st. Josh, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Jane.
Tomorrow on this program, green concepts of a different kind. The head of Vermont's Agency of Natural Resources will be our guest. Secretary Deb Markowitz will discuss Lake Champlain cleanup, the mandatory composting law that's phasing in, and a host of other issues under her agency's umbrella. You can send your question in advance to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us for our discussion with Deb Markowitz tomorrow. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.